2 days of sunshine, huh?
Wow.
This is really exciting. Gosh. Do you think it might happen again tomorrow?
Did you see the moon last night?
I didn't.
Oh.
It was full last night.
Yeah,
it was full last night.
Very nice.
Night before, too. The old
really?
Clouds are
I have to go look tonight.
Yeah. It got cloudy last night, so by the time I was looking outside, it wasn't. We were watching What Not to Wear.
That's right.
Me and Don.
I changed my wardrobe today entirely.
Oh, good for you.
just because. I thought, okay, shake it up here.
It's a good program. Have you watched it?
No.
Yeah.
It's quite good. These people are chosen by their friends, and they write to these two people and say, our friend really needs your help. And then whoever it is, secret footage is taken of them going to the store and going to work. It's quite funny, isn't it? So that they look at all these different ones and they choose which one they're going to work with. And it could be male or female, it could be old or young, it could be fat or skinny. It doesn't really have anything to do with it. It's just a wardrobe that is absolutely not right. You know, they'll say, okay, that one. And then they go and visit the person by surprise. And they say that congratulations, they've been chosen to go on What Not to Wear because all of their friends have voted them in. and they have been chosen to buy a whole new wardrobe, and they're given a credit card with $5,000 worth for a shopping trip, but they can only have the credit card if they agree to follow all the rules and turn over the whole wardrobe, right? So you have to decide whether to give up all your favorite old clothes. $5,000. What?
They have to give up all their old ones?
All their old wardrobe is subject to being thrown out. A couple of times they will actually let somebody keep something, but most of the time it's all. And then they have to, they have to bring all their old wardrobe. And then these people are merciless in their comments.
Yes.
I mean, they are just merciless. I mean, they just like rip it to shreds. And then they start building it up. Okay, your body type, you're way bigger on the top than you are at the bottom, you should be wearing light colors on the bottom, plainer colors on the top, you know, you have this shape, why don't you build it this way, you know, why do you present yourself like this, you know, you're really not, that's not really
who you
are.
You make yourself look like, what was that woman, like, sort of like a porn star or something.
Oh, yes.
They weren't very...
Oh, yeah, they're right. They go right for it.
Yeah.
They just like say exactly what it is you're doing. Like most of the people haven't actually looked at how they dress for like 20 years. And they don't even really realize how they dress because they don't know how to dress and they don't have time and they got 3 kids and, you know, whatever. And so they just go at them and then they trash their whole wardrobe and then they send them shopping with $5,000 the first day by themselves. But they watch through video cameras what they're doing. And then the second day, they join them. And there's usually a few little fights. I'm not going to try that on. You don't know whether you like it until you try it on. I know I don't like that. Try it on anyway. And then about halfway through the second day, you suddenly see them understand something about clothing and themselves and how to be in their bodies more comfortably, rather than just hiding or never looking at what they look like, you know. See them actually just being comfortable, and then they get their hair done. And some of them don't want their hair cut, don't want it uncut, you know. And then they get makeup. And then they go back to their families and their friends. It's a very interesting show because it's just in 4 days or 3 days or something?
I think it's a week, well...
Maybe
not a whole week, but it's within a week.
Yeah. And so they come and it just really lets you see how very often your habitual presentation affects your sense of yourself.
And you see their confidence, like something new emerged. Like first they're afraid of it, and then they step into this new
feeling who they are.
Yeah, and they like it so much.
They walk differently.
Yeah, everything is different. It's really neat. It's quite neat.
The other thing that's interesting is they can't see their makeup or the hairdo
until it's done.
Until it's all finished,
and then they go.
And then they're showing it, showing themselves.
Oh my God.
Yeah,
oh my God, is that
themselves.
Me? It's quite delightful, you know, especially if you like watching somebody being torn apart and then put back together. And they're happy about it in the end.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's so nice.
Yeah.
And their husbands and children and everything.
And they're all celebrating.
Yeah. What's this called?
What Not to Wear.
What Not to
Wear. TLC.
The other thing I found interesting was on the first day when they had the $5,000 credit card, they spent about $500. They think they spent a lot of money.
Oh, and they're bitching about it.
That's
spent $300 on a pair of shoes.
And then the next day, they're like, really, oh, go ahead, okay, $1,500 shoes. Big change.
And the lines that come out, you spent $300 on a pair of shoes that are going to last you for 10 years, and in the last 10 years you spent about $1,000 on pairs of shoes that you keep throwing out, or keep wearing, which is worse. It's quite fun. Meditation on the physical realm, how to change your mind from the outer in. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Sadhu. This is my favorite night. Well, one of my favorite nights. I'll say it was pretty good. But tonight's question night. So you got any questions for me?
We can cover some more of what we covered last night about karma. I think that's really, really important, and narrow it down, because I was kind of caught in that same, kind of wondering, what karma is, where it comes from, what kinds of things, like accidents, as opposed to, reaping what you sow.
Well, essentially, if you understand that the word karma just means action, and it only has power, it only reaps a result if those four qualities are there in a Buddhist term. In Buddhist terms, for it to be strong enough to actually manifest all four of those points that I iterated yesterday. Do you remember what they were? Remember the first one?
Desire.
Right. There has to be a strong desire, wish, wanting, right? Wanting to be alone, or wanting that person to shut up, or whatever it is. Wanting to be rich, something has to be there. Strong desire for a period of time. Then what's the second one?
Formulate a plan.
Start thinking about it. Start figuring it out. Start thinking about how you could do it. How you could do it. Well, I could do it there. I could do it there. Well, I could go off to Northwest Territories and head out in the bush and nobody would find me, I want to be alone. I could go to the Northwest Territories and hide out. You could do something like that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be like a certain period of time where you're trying to figure it out, think about it. Third one?
Action.
You have to do it. You do it. You act on it. And the fourth one? See the result. Feel the result. And be aware of the result. And so, like, have some sense of gratification or fear or whatever. And those four actions have to all be present for there to be an equal or a similar kind of resultant. Is that nice to know? So you actually have to know. You have to know if there is a cause and there is a result. You have to know. You have to see the whole process. This is a classical Buddhist teaching. Yes.
Sometimes, like on what level? Because sometimes you do things so habitually that there was a plan there, but it's happening so fast that...
You have to actually think about it and then figure out how you could do it and then do it. So it has to be conscious for it to be, to have what they call, you know, to be what they would, what you would really call, well, that is karma vipaka, that is a result of that action, and it was conscious and meant, and it's yours coming back to you, you know, in a way.
So we tend to think of it as being either accidental or
that's not true.
To us. Yeah.
The accidental is not yours or theirs or anywhere. This universe is falling apart, have you noticed? If a piece of it falls on Chicken Little, it ain't Chicken Little's fault. And like that letter said yesterday, which is such a beautiful letter, yeah, we're all here. So you could say, well, because we're here, something bad is going to happen eventually, you know? Because someday or other, you're going to get indigestion, aren't you? You got a stomach. It's pretty well guaranteed. Someday your hair will grow out, fall out, turn green, turn orange, right? Turn gray. Isn't that true? It's pretty well guaranteed. Like, the fact that we're born is already the action that is going to result in various states of suffering arising in our life. Whether or not we identify them as our fault, it's based on our misunderstanding of what is karma and what is karma vipaka. In a way, you could say we're not born here unless there is some reason that we fit. There has to be some desire that met here and was workable here. Maybe not a desire, understanding that sometimes we can be as attracted to something by hatred as by love. Helps, doesn't it? You know that. You know that if you're really afraid of something, you tend to see it. Or the possibility of it, or a shadow that reminds you of it, or... So that we can get fixated by the unpleasant as much as we can by... In fact, some people don't see the pleasant around them because they're so fixated by the unpleasant. Isn't that true? So, you know, that trying to talk at this moment about death, rebirth is like very tricky because any words I use I think are going to bring in the wrong idea. But although death is never, birth is never accidental, neither is it consciously premeditated. It's habitual more than anything. So the karma that is acting, the action that is present there, is the karma, the action, the motivation of ignorance. Ignorance is when you prefer to ignore something because you're holding to this. The biggest cause for our dissatisfactoriness is our ignorance. And it's so hard for us to understand that, isn't it? We keep thinking, if I just hold on to this, maybe everything will be all right, don't we? But that's not necessarily saying, well, look, that didn't work. Okay, now what shall I try? Is that true? So like that last stage of it, seeing the result of an action, is what maintains the ignorance. For a lot of us, we don't see the results of our actions. We just keep repeating the same action. Don't we? I don't know about you, but I do. Don't you? Don't you hold on to the same views? And how hard it is to let go of them, isn't it? And the fear that comes up when we think we might have to let go of them? Because at least we feel safe within that, you know, at least this is what we know, and who will we be if we don't do that? Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
Which is why we need each other. It's why we need each other. Because without each other, we will never have the hope of seeing someone else giving us a new idea or giving us the confidence to try something because they're trying it. Isn't that true? When you see someone else trying something, doesn't it loosen your possibilities? Maybe you don't change right away, but you're watching them like a hawk. So you're letting new information in. That's changing you. That's giving you more ease. Sangha is a refuge. Doesn't mean you like everybody. I mean, you don't have to like everybody. You don't have to be good buddies or prefer the same movies. In fact, sometimes your best sangha are people who you don't get along with. Because you see, well, here's somebody with totally different tastes than me, and we both want the same thing. We all desire happiness. That gives us something to work with together. So a lot of those, you know, little ways that we reassure each other when we like each other are not present, so we're more likely to be of real use to each other. Does that make sense? You know the saying, if I don't meditate for one day, I notice. What? If I don't meditate for 2 days?
Other people, friends.
No, my enemies notice. If I don't meditate for 3 days, everybody notices. So who gets it first, other than me? Enemies, the people that you don't get along with. They're your best sangha. Aren't they? We don't necessarily like it, but it's true. It depends on whether you really are interested. A lifetime is very short. Are you interested in finding some kind of refuge? A real refuge. A real refuge. One that can't be moved or shattered. One that can't be lost, or you can't be lost. That's worthwhile. It doesn't matter if you don't find it until you're on your deathbed. But that's your aspiration. Now that would be a karma to develop, wouldn't it? Mm-hmm. That would be a desire, a thinking about, an acting on, and seeing the result. If your aspiration was really refuge, then if something didn't work, you'd say, okay, you can check that one off the list. It wouldn't devastate you, would it? You wouldn't think, well, maybe if I did it again with my hair dyed green, well, if I got a tattoo on my left cheek, you know, oh, I got to change, you know, my toothpaste, maybe that will make it work, you know? It would be like, no, well, that didn't work. I've given it a good try. Okay, now what could be refuge? Is that true? If your aspiration was really to find refuge, then your thoughts would be, okay, well, what is refuge? Well, and then you would actually find out for yourself, what is refuge to you? Does your refuge depend on other people? Well, best of Irish luck. Huh? Does your refuge depend on you being in control? Go visit a nursing home. Have a look.
This is your future.
Does this make sense? So rather than going more into, you know, well, what is your karma and what isn't your karma, understand that basically what decides your karma, if your karma even exists, is the motives. What is your motive? And basically motives of altruism bring you more happiness than motives of fear and selfishness. And if you've never read Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, I really recommend you read it. It is really one of the most beautiful books written. How many of you have actually read it? How many of you heard me talk about it before? How many of you aren't going to answer no matter what I ask? Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning. It's not a big book. It's not a hard read. I really, really think you would find it very useful. That book has transformed Western thought for 60 years, for 50, I guess it's 55, 50 years old, 55 years old, that book. Probably first printed.
You read it probably for World War II or something.
Yeah, probably about 10 years after World War II it was probably printed. And it has transformed, certainly a large part of Western thought. Beautiful book. Have I sold it to you? Yes. Really, really worth reading. So, can you remember ever giving someone something, some small thing that you gave to someone that they really liked? All of you, can you remember something like that? To let yourself really remember that. When you actually gave it to them. What's the feeling that comes up when you remember that?
Joy.
Can you remember really wanting something for yourself sometime in your life and getting it for yourself? Mm-hmm. Could be anything, a bottle of wine. What's the feeling that comes up with that? Is it the same joy?
No.
What's different about it?
Not as deep.
It isn't as deep?
Because I'm trying to pull away.
Yeah, it's sort of like a little flicker, but it's like, yeah, so what? I need another one now. The kindness you do to others is more of a refuge than trying to take care of yourself. You actually get more peacefulness, more contentment, more ease with the world by what you do for others than you do for you, than what you do for yourself. But when we're frightened or caught, that's not how we think, is it? Unless you're an extremely amazing person like Viktor Frankl, and you write a book like Man's Search for Meaning about that experience, we have more sense of a meaning from what we have been generous with than we do with what we have been selfish with. Much more profound. Much more profound. When you actually acknowledge that that's true, when you find yourself in a difficult confrontation, it's more likely if your aspiration has been to find refuge, you will not be intent on trying to create your safety. You will be trying to see how you can give that person a space that is useful to them. There's a big difference. Isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Huge difference.
One creates a sense of fear and defensiveness. The other one is like openness, and the space does change. doesn't it? So you see, if we all actually started practicing the motive to find refuge, at some point or other, it would take us to altruism, to kindness. And when we're practicing kindness, we're not trying to hold to something for ourselves, so the ignorance gets less. Because we're more willing to try to see what we don't usually see, so we're not ignoring as much. The first of the paramis, generosity. Why? Because it's the swiftest, most profound, beautiful way to find refuge. So simple. That nobody ever wants to believe in. But 6 times a day to practice giving. And then at night, run through the 6 things you gave that day. You do that for a week, you do that for 3 weeks, you'll find you start changing, you'll find you start feeling more comfortable. I guarantee that. Regardless of your sin. 6 times a day, imagine giving something. Only 2 of them should be physical. Give your eyes a moment to look at the sky. And you watch the giving. And then you drop it. And then next one, a moment of smiling at Ruth. And you drop that one. A moment of smelling, see if I can pick out Otto's body odor from Kathy's. Give my nose smell. Drop that one. So what you do is you name what you're going to give, and then you consciously give it. It could be to yourself, it can be out there, it doesn't matter. Only 2 of them should be actual material, like give money to a homeless person or, you know. Only 2 of them should actually be material. You do the giving, 6 givings a day, and you watch the giving, and then when you're going to sleep at night, you remember the 6 givings. And you don't go into whether or not they were successful or whether that person used the money for wine, or it's none of that. What you're focusing on is the altruism, the giving. 6 givings a day. It is a beautiful, beautiful practice. You suddenly start to feel more at ease in your being. Have more trust of the people around you. A beautiful practice. Generosity, the first parami, isn't it? Mm-hmm. We sort of just sort of brush over it. Oh yeah, generosity. Know what I mean? Oh yeah, generosity, yeah.
I know what that means.
Yeah, I know. It's in the G section of the dictionary, isn't it?
Took that at Sunday school.
Yeah. But to actually make a daily practice of playing with it, you know, just to explore it. And see, does that change your mind? See, if you're interested in refuge, then this would be very easy to do. If you're not interested in refuge, if you're interested in ignorance, then you're going to ignore this. Aren't you? I did. I don't see you that much different than me. I had a good idea ignoring most of the advice my teachers gave me for quite a while, which is why I think I'm a fairly reasonable teacher. You know, just how creative you can be. So, is that okay? I would rather not talk about karma, I would rather talk about aspiration. You know, the desire, motive. The Buddha said karma is chetana. Chetana means motive. Your action is based on your motive. So if you start playing around with seeing whether you can 6 times a day have a different motive than you habitually have, watch and see what happens to your karma. Any other questions, answers?
I think the other thing you said with karma too, kind of the danger there is, you said that that's a person karma. Something happens that's negative to a person, and you say, well, it's their karma. You end up just sitting there, and there's no action of compassion that really goes forward. It's,
exactly.
You know, I find that's a real dangerous way of thinking, because it doesn't lead anywhere.
Yeah, it's basically superstition rather than faith, using faith well. And I find that in our culture, one of the things many of us miss is how to use faith. We don't know how to use devotion or faith. So we use it like with a particular medicine or a particular, you know, some people change the medicine all the time, or, you know, or a particular a product that we like, or, you know, a particular a kind of, you know, some web thing. Is that true? We have our devotion hopping around to different name brands all the time, don't we? But it's all devotion in a solidified form, isn't it? Because we love to be logical in our devotion. The thing about devotion that is so powerful is you can get your devotion running full speed into a question mark. That means you're devoted to unknowing. Do you understand what that means? Do you realize that if you are willing to open your being to the universe, it might come in? And we keep trying to package our devotion. It's all superstition. It's like we're trying to fit it into some place where we could be safe with it. I mean, I know most people wouldn't call what they do devotion, but when I watch people, and myself included, I see just devotion moving there, right? And people are devoted to negativity. Isn't that true? It's like their whole devotion is caught up in not trusting. And so that's their God. Remember me a few years ago asking you who your real God was? Remember that? I don't know. I was on that kick for a while. Remember that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. And it's an interesting question, you know, who is it, what is it that you bow to? Is it something that is beyond what you know, so that there is possibility in your life? Or is it something that you want to fit into your life so that there can be some kind of safety? But you know what, my friend? There is no safety. Damn! On the other hand, there doesn't need to be. Because there's nothing to hold in a position of practicing making it safe. There's nothing to keep safe. There's only, you know, I love the way Ram Dass did it at a lecture he gave once. He was sitting there, this was before his stroke, he's sitting there and he's pouring himself a glass of water, and he said, God pouring God into God. If your aspiration is like that for the unknown, then you are also the unknown. God pouring God into God. St. John of the Cross, when, you know, he was being disciplined by his peers, for hanging out with St. Teresa of Avila. Discussing Avila and, you know, her nuns seemed to think that they could have actually pray. I mean, what was their problem? And he was writing his poetry. And in the midst of some of the more, torturous events that happened at that time, he wrote one poem. And he said in the poem, I can't remember exactly the words, but translates something like, oh, my dear, I am dying of my love for you. What shall I do? And the beloved replied, then die, my darling. Die to that all that is not us. Die to everything that is not us. What could be more beautiful? Isn't that an amazing poem? Die to all of me and you and open to the big. Don't hold for answers. Open your faith. You're a mystery. Faith opens the mystery to a greater understanding. But start with generosity and work your way up to faith. It's the aspiration you want to work with. Practice generosity in the world. Pretty soon you start being more generous with yourself. You allow moments of faith without a brand name on them. Yeah! Good stuff. Good stuff. That kind of power of the faith that St. John is talking about. In Buddhism, we call that sympathetic joy. That passion for unknowing that we all have, but it takes some kind of confidence, of generosity over a long period of time before we let it just rip. Don't try to hold on to any safety. Let it just rip. That's where we want to be. But to be that way, we have to have kindness and compassion in the world. So that then our hearts are free to pray without a name. Not go around spouting our commercials to everybody. Because it's when we're spouting our commercials that wars start, isn't it? I mean, I like free trade and all that stuff. You know, I like that. I like our commodity. I am very fond of commodities myself. But the commercials, you know, if you take them seriously, that's just another war game. Isn't it? Does that not answer your question successfully? Yeah, it was you who was talking about karma and when people say that's your karma. I was taking off from that, wasn't I? Isn't that where I took off from?
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
It was a comment.
I know I sort of took off, yeah.
It was a comment.
Yeah, okay, excuse me. Exactly. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
I guess it's a question that comes from the Star Weekend of the planet. And yeah.
That was so great. Next time, everybody has to come and bring all their kids. Your kids would have loved it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah, sorry.
And I don't know if it ties into karma, but my question...
And we got to kidnap Adrea and just throw her in the car, because, like, you know, she would have been bouncing around the fields with it. Bring a cot so she can catch cat naps in between novas. Yeah, sorry.
Okay, but on the second day, I mean, I guess the comment was made, well, I'm not
comment, but maybe the question came up was, like, is there order in the universe? And then the second part to that is, I was reading something in Shambhala where there was a quote that said that God doesn't play dice with the universe.
That's Einstein.
Einstein said that, yeah. So can you just comment on that, Sarah?
Yeah, I don't know whether Einstein ever gambled, though.
What?
Oh, you want me to make some other comment?
There was a question and a comment, and a comment and a question. I don't know.
It's really sick when I think I'm funny, isn't it? Okay. See, like from a Buddhist point of view, you have to really get to the point of calm in yourself and willingness to let go a lot of your answers before you can actually come to the really interesting questions. And one of the really interesting questions is, other than the viewer, other than the order imposed by the viewer, is there an order? It isn't out there. As first is, how does the looker affect the lookee? So, for example, wasn't it on that weekend where they talked about to a whale we would be like flies? Didn't they mention that? Or was that something
of
I
speed,
read?
Relative speed.
Yeah, relative speed. Then how to catch a fly is... How you catch a fly is like,
yeah,
you just have a wall moving closer because they don't notice that.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're swatting them, they move that fast, so that's easy for them. But if we were in relation to a whale, we would be more like a fly buzzing. Do you remember that?
Well, something to that effect, yeah. Depending on who's viewing.
Yeah, the whale would be to looking at us more like we look at flies.
Okay.
Is that okay?
That's okay. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And taking that and looking directly at that, you can see how one's mind goes, oh, really? Because we assume our truth to be out there, don't we? When people meet cats and dogs, they put their hand out like this very often, don't they?
Yes.
And if the cat or dog hasn't spent a lot of time around a person, they'll back off, won't they, or shrink down. Why?
Claws.
Yeah. Because that's a claw. You're attacking them.
Mm-hmm.
From their perspective, you're not reaching out to touch them. Does that make sense?
So
from that point of view of a cat, the order of the universe would be very different from the point of view of a human.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Yeah.
From the point of view of an autistic person, the point of view of the rest of the world, because their sensory input is so profound,
mm-hmm,
right?
Yeah.
And the meaning, well, like, you know, this friend of mine who works with autistic, has done a lot of work with us, was telling me that what is most difficult for people with autism is trying to attach the meaning to words, because words and meanings and the facial just, you know, movements and stuff, because that is not how their brain symbolizes. True?
Yes.
Oh, if somebody is schizophrenic, their reality is very different than yours. So if they're looking at the universe and saying, is there order, they're not going to come up with the same way proofs that you are they?
No.
Or is a fly going to come up with the same proofs you do? Or a whale? So first you have to look at, is there a universe? Or what is order? Who is seeing? You have to define the perceiver before you can start talking about the perceived. This is the Buddhist approach.
Okay.
And you know that nice word papancha that we did the other day?
Yeah.
The actual quote that I used to chant every day. So far as the world of the sixfold sense spheres extends, so far extends the papancha, the so far as the papancha extends, so far extends the sixfold sense. With the fading away and passing of either of the papancha is the fading away and passing of the sixfold sense world. So according to the Buddha, the way I see the world is dependent on the billions of moments of my brain creating diverse views and filling it in. And when I actually am able to see those as process and no longer believe them, then there is a totally different experience of the universe. So order might not even come into it. Just the same as when he talked about what is it to be awake, and the answer is gone out. What is gone out? What is in? So what we're talking about here from a Buddhist point of view doesn't translate the same way.
Okay, so when you talk about processes, you just see the processes. That's not the same thing as you see the cause and effect. That's different.
Why would that be different?
No, I don't know. Is that the same?
No, but there are so many levels of cause and effect, like how the senses operate in humidity.
Yeah.
As opposed to on a dry day, or when you're happy, or when you're sad. I mean, like, it's like so complex. And so really, it becomes not so much seeing, although that is one aspect, seeing the process is another aspect, is seeing that what is consciousness between the views. Did that make sense to you? Or do you want me to say it another way?
Say it another way.
You know that thing I was saying about when you look in a movie and you see a wheel turning backward?
Yeah.
And that's because the movie takes, the film takes a picture before the wheel has done a full rep. So the wheel is turning this way because the car is going that way.
Yeah.
And so the first time the movie film takes a picture, one spoke is here, and then it keeps turning, but before it's got even there, the next frame is here. The picture is taken there, and then the picture is taken there, because it doesn't take a picture at every full revolution, nor every second. So what you see is not quite complete turn of the wheel. What you see is it looks like the frame is going backward, right?
Yeah.
And that's the same with our brains, right?
We're not seeing it all.
No, what we are seeing is a gap,
yeah,
and then a picture, and then a gap, and then
a
picture, right?
Yeah,
so what is it that is, what is consciousness in that gap would have to be, because like we're placing it, placing our information through a glass darkly. And like to actually be, is it possible to explore the mind? Is it possible to mind the gap? Is it possible to be conscious in the gap? The gap when I am not present. Now, according to the Buddhist tradition, that's called enlightenment. And the rest is called illusion. And it isn't that it isn't true, it's that it's one way of seeing based on these causes and conditions, this way of seeing. And every way everybody sees is valid, because there are causes and conditions for seeing that way. But whether it is refuge, whether it will lead to happiness, whether it will lead to satisfaction, that's a whole other story. That you see according to how you see is certainly valid. But whether that is refuge, that's a whole different question. So, okay?
Oh, yeah, it's a word on you.
Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
When you talk about order, that was really interesting, because, I mean, it talk about the analogy of the whale and the fly.
The whale and the person and the fly.
Yeah. But
person as fly.
We're out in the country standing there looking through these exotic, complicated telescopes to see these objects that are billions of light years away, which is a galaxy. But what we want to see, to satisfy our sense of order, is a whole galaxy. It's much more satisfying. Oh, look, it's a spiral shape. Oh, look, this one's on its edge. And then we're standing there in the middle of a whole galaxy, right?
Exactly.
But that's not so interesting as looking at the one far away, because we have this need to see order and a pattern within that, because that is more comforting than sort of, well, you're in the middle of it, but you can't grok the whole thing at once. So it's like chaotic. But the binoculars looking into the galaxy we're in, you know, I was sitting there going, yeah, but here's the $50 binoculars, and wow, we can really get a shot of this guy. You know, and the little picture was just the same as the book, really.
Mm-hmm.
Except that you actually saw it, like,
mm-hmm.
right
except
now.
Except you were there.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I'm not...
I understand, you know, totally what you're saying.
But it's, all I'm commenting on is how interesting human beings are when we say, well, yeah, that's the pattern. Well, yeah, it is a pattern at one perspective, at one moment in time, because you're seeing a freeze frame of that condition. But it doesn't mean anything. Cause
and the seeing is also conditioned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But from that religion spring forth. And dogma is born.
Absolutely. Why? Mostly because we want to be safe.
Yeah.
We want the right answer. We want to feel comfortable. We like everything to fit into our view. Don't we? It's so much nicer when everybody agrees with me. Do you find that too? Yeah. Oh, excellent. Let's start our list. Any other?
If whether the universe has form is dependent on who is viewing the universe.
The form that is seen is certainly dependent on the seer.
Because weren't the stars in that shape before you saw them? I haven't seen them.
I don't know. I still don't know.
So
I still don't know. But I know that I, in this body, see stars, and you do, and, you know, and I know that the coyotes howl at the moon, and I know certain things, so I can assume certain things, but not until I actually have an experience of a coyote's mind can I say more than that.
If I don't see the stars, like if we go back from the years when we don't have people that are looking at the stars, were they still there?
Yeah, this is one of the oldest questions in philosophy, my dear. And don't be too quick to answer it. Excuse me, just a minute. Yeah. Don't be too quick to answer it. It's like a really good question. And really just hold this question and really be curious about it. Like, check it out. You know that there's lots of evidence that a lot of times people have not seen something that was right there because they hadn't had any experience of it. You know that, don't you?
Yeah.
And so, does that mean it wasn't there? But then, you know, it's a very interesting thing. I know that sometimes there are animals that you meet that, you know, I have been places where animals have never been hunted. And so you can be sitting there, and a bear that is well fed will walk right by, and they will smell you, and they will even come up and sniff you, and then they'll walk past because you're not interesting to them. They won't feel like they have to protect their cub or anything because they don't have any relationship to you. So you're no more interesting. You know, I was talking last night about being on the deck of the ship and meditating, and then at the moment of cognition, I was in a fairly concentrated state, and this man opened the door, and walked out of the deck, walked out of the engine room where he was and onto the deck, and I watched the cognition of that, and then I watched the perception of it. I watched like 1, 2, 3. It was like just bing, bing, bing. And very often we cognize things, but we don't perceive them because they're not meaningful to us. They don't have any, like you're walking down the street, you don't see all the cigarette butts, do you? Do you? But if somebody had dropped two toonies, would you see them?
Yes.
Would you?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you wouldn't even think later about saying how many cigarette butts you found, right? But you would say, I found 20 toonies on the, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And it would be something you'd remember for a long time. But the cigarette butts are gone. So there's a cognition, but no particular meaning to it, no attachment. So like, what does that mean if I don't see the stars, or if I see the stars, you know? Like, how much of what you see do you actually see? Like, you really have to study what seeing is, or what hearing is. I told you about the writer, my friend, what was his name, William, I've forgotten his last name, famous writer. He was a bit of a heroin user when I knew him, and a really sharp mind, wrote prose. Oh God, sorry, getting old, it must be true. And one time he was really interested in whether or not, because he had almost like photographic memory. And so one time, and he loved sound, so one time he decided he would go out and tape record. Go for a walk around for like 5-10 minutes and tape record it, and then come back and write down everything he heard and then play the tape recorder and see whether he was it, because he thought he heard everything, right? And he wrote down everything he wrote for a long, long time, then he played the tape recorder, and he was shocked by how much he hadn't heard. Does this apply at all to your question? Does that mean those sounds weren't there?
They were there.
But he didn't hear them. He didn't know they were there. So, from what point of view? From his point of view, they weren't there. From somebody else's point of view, some of them would be there, and some of the ones he heard wouldn't be there. So this is where you go in Buddhism. In Buddhism, you go to, well, who is here first? So I can see who is hearing and what the hearing depends on. And then when I know what the receptor is, then I can see, understand the rules for reception. Why are you looking puzzled? Did you get that?
I guess I want to know if there's something absolutely there.
That's a really good question, and maybe you have to start to see whether there's something absolutely here. Because if there's not something absolutely here, how will you identify something absolutely there?
I think there is, except that...
I think therefore it is. Nice questions though, aren't they? I know you would prefer nice answers,
yes.
But they are nice questions. <aren't they? laughs>
What about all
Ms.
the
Bonnie?
Other, all the other beings, like bacteria and stuff?
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Flies and whales, but you could go the viruses or beings in your belly that make it possible. Well, the mitochondria that make it possible for you to oxidize. You know, you can digest your food without all those little symbiotic relationships that totally depend on you, and you totally depend on them.
Yeah.
you are a universe to a whole lot of beings. And I don't know whether you're really there or not either. Yes, Wayne.
No.
So did you want to say more, Bonnie?
Well, what does it mean if we get someone else to agree? So, like, the stars are there, and Don didn't know they were there. And I had this weekend, and now he sees they're there. Does that mean they were there?
That means his view of the universe is changeable.
He's changed. The universe hasn't changed.
I'm saying the view, that means his view of the universe is changeable. That means change is possible. Therefore, before he could see them, was that true? Or after he could see it, was that true? Or is change true?
Change is true.
Yeah, that's all. Yes.
No, I was just, you were saying, it is this here, and one of the things Rob pointed out quite clearly is that we really don't exist. I mean, there's no such thing, we're not solid objects in any stretch, not even close. It really gives a new meaning to hollow body meditation.
Yeah.
Big time.
Mm-hmm.
Just mm-hmm. hollow body, the hollow body thing I do with much
more interest
every time now. It's
mostly
very,
space.
It's
mostly
so
space.
Important to do that for me now.
It's we're mostly space.
Yeah.
And then water. And after space, we're mostly water.
Except if you go down into the water's all space.
I know.
And
I'm saying we're mostly space, and then the next one is water. Most people, I'm counting the water in the space.
Well, I was just looking at it like.
I know you are. I know you are.
Okay.
I know you are.
Okay.
And it's true. Because spacer is the container. Space in Buddhism, the elements, you know, you've heard me going on and on about the elements for years, haven't you? Oh God, here she goes on about the elements again. Oh shit. She's on about those elements. Always on. Space is the container and the separator of all the other elements. So there is, within any element, there is space. Without any element. Yeah, true. I'm saying if you could measure the elements just themselves, they're not inseparable, but if you could, the greatest quantity of our body is space, the next greatest quantity is water. So neither of those are particularly solid. It is, however, true that, what is that, 0.26 of a gram difference between a live body and a dead body? Is that what it is? Something like that. Isn't that interesting? 0.26. Something like that. Now, who else had... You had read?
I can't remember the first part, but last night you said that something was... I can't remember the second part either, but you said that that it didn't matter how... If you were old or not, you said that. You didn't say that, but I that's what I think you said.
You don't know whether it was when I was talking about that letter or.
You were talking about. I think you were talking about being present.
And it didn't matter how old you are.
Yeah,
it's true.
Conception.
It doesn't matter. It has nothing to do with time.
You said that
you can learn how to be present while you're dying, and that will be enough.
That's good.
It is, and that's the point. That's why I say to you, would you like, you know, what you, if you're dying, never mind that you're dying, why don't you focus on what mind state you want to be in when you die? Isn't that what I say to you?
Is what you said in the interview?
I said it on the phone to you.
Yeah.
So this is like what I'm saying to you. Like, we're all dying, we don't know when we're going to die, but what mind state, if you are dying now, what mind state do you want to be in? That's what I can help you with. Isn't that what I said? And what I'm talking about is like to teach you how to be present, not going over the past or focusing on the future. That's the most important thing, mind state, to develop, isn't it?
Yeah.
So is that what you were talking about?
I think so.
I agree. Here's to it. Remember, one way you could do it is practicing generosity 6 times a day. Very useful.
But it's difficult for me to be generous?
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
Why?
Because it is.
That's not good enough. What do you mean?
I tried that.
Tried what?
To be generous.
How?
With a whole bunch of things.
Give me an example.
It was a long time ago. I can't remember.
Tell me something this week that you were generous with.
I was not generous this week.
Did you eat dinner tonight?
Yes, I did.
Wasn't that being generous to your body?
Yeah, I guess so.
Nah, 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 nah.
I didn't know
did
that.
Did you just breathe in?
Yes.
Wasn't that generous to your body?
Nah,
nah, nah, nah, nah. Did you just smile at me?
Yes.
Wasn't that generous to me? Yeah, 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 yeah.
She remembered I didn't see the tea last night.
There you go.
That was very generous.
There you go, see?
It was.
So, but what I'm saying to you is that you're not seeing the generosity. So that's why this exercise is very important, because it teaches you how to see the little moments. Okay, I'm going to give a moment of looking at Andrea to my eyes. And I'm looking at you, but I'm conscious that I'm giving this to my eyes. So I'm being generous to my eyes.
I was being generous.
And then that's done. And then I let go of it.
With my eyes?
Yeah. Or I'm going to give a moment of feeling the air on my skin to my skin. That's generosity, you see? So like thinking about it, then doing it, and then letting it go. And then tonight when I go to bed, I'll say, okay, what 6 givings did I do today? Well, I gave a moment of looking at the blue sky, and I gave a smile to Ruth, and I looked at Andrea, you know? And I gave a feeling of this, and I tried seeing if I could pick out the smell of different people in the class. Oh, okay. Oh, that's only 5. Okay, I get up. Now I'm going to give myself the right to go to bed. That's 6. So it's not that there are actions you're not performing. It's that when you're while you're doing them, you say, okay, I'm going to give this to myself. Something you're already doing. You make it a conscious thing and you give it to yourself. Or you give it to somebody else, a smile to somebody else. Or if somebody doesn't want anyone to talk to them, a silence to somebody else. It doesn't matter. But you watch the giving, and then at night you collect them. Okay, what were the 6 givings today? That's all. And you don't worry about whether they're the good gifts or bad gifts or in-between gifts. You just name, oh yeah, I gave this, I gave this, I gave this, I gave this, I gave this. If you can't remember them, you know, make one up. And then the next day you do it again. You do it like for 3 weeks, I guarantee you'll notice a difference in your ability to be present with awareness, and therefore better mind state for dying. Do you want that written down for you?
No. I can remember the 6 givings.
Good.
So do for 3 weeks, and how does it change?
I'm just telling her.
Oh. No.
You do through for 3 weeks, and then you tell me in 3 weeks. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? I like these, like, stir it up a little bit. Start questions you guys are coming up with. This is good. How do we know the stars are real? Well, indeed. Wayne, here. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a different one again. I told you the question, but I've been reading Chappelle.
Wasn't this the guy who never used to ask questions? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love it.
I'm on a roll right now.
I love it.
Apparently, you talked about this once before, and I don't remember, but can you talk about, there's a mention of what's a Tibetan culture or whatever, or Tibetan practice, they have what's called day logs.
Day logs?
Yeah.
They have what?
I think they'll be monks. Individuals who will they will leave the body and go and come back again?
Probably.
Oh, you haven't heard of that?
I'm sure they have. I mean, in most cultures that exists. It was very important in the Native American culture in North America. That was how they found game, or, you know, knew what the weather was going to be or stuff, and it's part of survival.
Well, this is
the
Bardo, I guess.
Yeah, I'm sure. Okay. Some people do that very easily, and some people don't, you know, so some people have a talent for that. How they trained the Tibetan monks, because of course women weren't ordained, because they figured it was too arduous a trip for women to go to India to be ordained. I don't think they asked the women, but you know, poor dears, they have to stay home and have babies, which isn't hard at all. But whoops, sorry. Is that on tape? Oh no. How they trained monks was you get, for most of the monks, the ones that were recognized as tokus, they just get all these, you know, 7-year-old boys all in a room, and they don't have enough text for everybody, so they get them to chant after the teacher these chants over and over again, listening and learning it by rote. And the language that most of the teaching is in is not spoken Tibetan language. It's another language. So most of it is totally incomprehensible to most of these young lads. Did you know that? Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. And some of them are really good at catching on with it, and you know, and chant really, really well. And maybe some of them start beating their thighs. So after, if they keep that up for a few months or years, then they're pulled out and maybe given a drum or a horn. And some of them keep saying, what are we chanting? Oh, this word sounds like, I know, what is this? Why do we chant this? Why do we chant this when this is happening? And if they just keep asking those annoying questions, and they're given out, they're pulled out, and they're given a little teaching about the meaning of a sadhana. This is a four-armed figure, you know, beginning. And if some of them sit around and they're always drawing in the sand, then they're taught how to paint, right? You get this? So that if some of them start tripping out when it gets hypnotic, and then coming back and telling you that they just watched 15 birds land on the potala and they're, you know, you're 50 miles away, then they're pulled out and given a different training. Because the whole educational system is different. So there was recognized different talents and people were channeled that way. Somebody who is the, what's he called, the seer, the one who...
Oracle?
The oracle. I mean, that's a very high position. And very specific positions were looked for, because there aren't that many oracles of that ability. So that one would be, you know, particular. But there are other oracles too, but not of that... And that one is a tolku too, generally speaking, either tolku or family. So it's a totally different culture, and they're totally different. In Native American, most of the Native American, certainly the Native American tribes that were nomadic, you had to also be able, you know, your shaman, so-called shaman, your medicine man, or whatever you want to call them, had to be able to leave their body, sit and go into a state and leave their bodies and say, well, the buffalo went that way, you know, or a war party's coming from that direction. Because you notice they didn't have telegraph lines or satellite TV. So, but the communication was essential for... So it's like things that arise as part of a culture. So us Westerners, you know, with our very strong reaction to wanting to separate, wanting to be logical, and, you know, what you see is what you get, then the whole science thing has become super strong. And so you have these subcults of faith that are like in toothpaste or in a religion or something, but it's almost like they're subcultures. Does that make sense? Most of our faith is some kind of subculture. Mm-hmm. But not very many people actually take faith as something to really study in a scientific way, do they? You know, most of us, we're like advertising is pretty good for weaning people into a faith, isn't it? You can't tell me that all those people who buy those magazines in the checkout counter that say you too can lose 45 pounds in 3 weeks actually do believe they're going to lose 45. I'm sorry, you know, week after week after week, the same headline. I don't think so. Do you think so? I don't think so somehow. I think that there's like a faith and I keep going back to the priest and maybe, you know. I'm finished my rant now. If you have something more to say here.
I'm not sure if I understand the difference, because the secretary mentioned it tonight, it was the difference between the culture and the subculture in terms of faith. Something that I'm getting.
Whatever we have faith in, you know, that's where we put our energy. And for most of our cultures, what you have faith in is what allows you to survive. Mm-hmm. Our culture for the last 150 years, 200 years, has survived through marketing. So we have faith in being cash cows. The faith is starting to crumble, but you hear a lot of voices saying you just have to keep faith, don't you? And patriotic statements about how important it is to keep faith, don't you? Mm-hmm. We have faith in the normal, meaning go back to work and buy that magazine. Don't we? Mm-hmm. See, because the thing about faith is that it's a power, and any icon will be empowered by it. So if you have the icon of being able to travel and see other circumstances and then come back in your body, you're going to be able to do it. Not everybody is going to be able to do it, but not everybody's a millionaire. But if one person is going to do it, everybody else is going to either want their autograph or say why it shouldn't be done, or, right? Mm-hmm. Because we all have our contradictory faiths. I don't have any problem believing that there is quite possible to have a healthy culture based on medicinal herbs. I think that, you know, however, if I was hit by a truck, I would rather not have medicinal herbs. And I think that all of the cultures have something to offer. Does that make sense? That is to say, I think that faith is capable of being used in many different ways, not just the way we habitually use it. Now we're getting into a rising yoga. Practice this visualization. Pretend you believe it's real. Dissolve it. Do this habitually for a period of time. See how it changes your mind. Like, yeah. We already practice all these visualizations every time we're standing in line at the checkout counter looking at the gum that'll clear up your breath. And, you know? It all goes flickering through back there somewhere, whether we buy it or not. Is that sometime or other we bought it. Unless we're really good at ignorance. We'll see.
Thank you.
Did you have a question?
No, I was just probably scratching my face.
Don? Or who had a question? Did you have a question? Did you have a question?
Well, I did.
Comment? Answer?
It was just sometimes on retreat, I remember one time at River Lodge, when you get in a more mindful state, your habitual seeing of the forest and the path is the forest and the path, yeah, I know, yada yada. And I remember one time in particular, it was just, you know, a short kind of thing, but all of a sudden, it wasn't solid. Everything was like, it was like, I don't know, it was kind of like seeing everything the way, maybe the way the natives saw the boat on the water suddenly. Just for a little bit, none of the rules were applying.
Exactly.
And I just had this feeling like, well, maybe it's really like that all the time, and it's just, I'm not seeing that because I'm staying to the rigid parameters that I know to be true and that are safe.
Mm-hmm. The power of ignorance.
Yeah. It was magical for a second.
It is. It's always magical. Whether I let it in or not is the only question. It. Inner it and utter it. Always magical. Everything is possible. That's why enlightenment is possible. Because everything is possible. That's the good news. That's also the bad news. So is that an adequate sufficiency for this evening? Feel properly battered? Thank you. You feel this extremely beautiful gold light in your hearts? Spreads through your body. All your pores fills this room. The house, the whole block, the city, the whole country, the world, into space. Anyone you want to pray for, anywhere they're suffering, just imagine it being washed with the light. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings. So thank you for your great compassion.